Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Turkish ground forces seized at least one village from Kurdish fighters in northern Syria today, and the area is being pounded with airstrikes and artillery. Turkey launched the offensive yesterday after President Trump said he was pulling American troops out of the region. Joining us now is former Congresswoman Jane Harman, president and CEO of the Wilson Center. Welcome back.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And first of all, what do you make of what's going on right now and Turkey's invasion now day two into northern Syria?
It's hard to make anything sensible of it. I think that President Trump's decision was process-free. He consulted no one. After it, Mick Mulvaney, who apparently was in his office with him or wherever he made the phone call, had to scramble to tell the Secretary of Defense. It was process-free. The consequences are enormous, and they're enormous on two levels. One is the consequences in the region and with our allies, but the second is the consequences in the United States Senate, which is at the moment looking at this other thing, starts with I, that's going on in Washington, D.C. And if Lindsey Graham is right, that 85 to 90 senators oppose this action, he's just made a whole bunch of folks wonder about whether he should be president.
You think that what's going on right now in Syria has an effect on whether Republicans are going to support the president on impeachment? Because so far, they've been willing to criticize him on what's happening with Turkey, but they have not been willing to criticize him, many of them, on the call with Ukraine.
I'm just saying it's a possibility, and I'm not a cheerleader for impeachment. I think it's a very rough thing to happen in the United States, period. And I have seen two of them. One was Nixon, and I was a member of Congress during Clinton. Mm-hmm. They had very different results, but nonetheless, it's a very painful and serious remedy. And the country is increasingly supportive of it. I'm just hearing about the polls. But nonetheless, my point is that 90 senators, they're not all Republicans, but certainly a majority, you'd think, of both the Republicans and the Democrats in the Senate, for sure, are questioning this policy, which will have very serious ramifications in the Middle East.
The White House says it did not give Turkey's president the green light for this offensive. Do you believe that?
Well, that's what President Trump is saying. He's saying, I said we would pull our troops out. Then we told Turkey not to move in. Well, we created a vacuum. And as I see this, we have just given a great big permission slip to Turkey, Russia, and Iran, plus the Syrian government, which, as we see all over the airwaves, has been seriously torturing and massacring and using chemical gas on its people to do whatever they want. And in case anybody missed it, there's a long Syrian border adjacent to Israel, and the Israelis are now freaking out.
The Israelis are now freaking out. You're hearing that?
Yes, I'm hearing that they're enormously uncomfortable. First of all, their government is in some free fall. But in addition to that, Iran now has a permission slip to be active in Syria. And Iran also, so reports are saying, is giving kits to Hezbollah fighters along the Lebanese border with Israel to turn what were dumb missiles aimed at Israel into precision-guided munitions, meaning they can be targeted precisely. If there are tens of thousands of missiles along Israel's border with Lebanon, and there's now Iran along the Syrian border with Israel, and there is Tehran calling for the annihilation of Israel, if I were in Israel, I'd be pretty worried.
So obviously, just based on what you've just said, this gets very complicated very quickly. Turkey is in such an important place in the Middle East and also neighboring Europe. And I want to ask you about something else involving that. In the course of all of the refugee crises that have happened in the last few years, Turkey has taken in millions of people. And today, the president, Erdogan, said that Ankara will send the 3.6 million Syrian refugees in Turkey to Europe if European countries label the country's military incursion in Syria as an occupation.
My mouth can't be further open listening to this. Let's also understand that the Turkish border with Syria has been porous over the years, which is how some Europeans ended up in Syria as ISIS fighters. Some of those folks are in prison. Numbers of them are probably of European origin. If those prisons aren't guarded and the Turks are much less interested in ISIS than they are in stopping the Kurds. So let's imagine some of those ISIS fighters go back into Europe through Turkey, target Europe, and through Europe target us. Then what have we done? What has President Trump done? He has revived and increased the menace from ISIS.
So what would your message be to people in Congress right now? Is there anything that they can do to deal with this problem, or is it too late?
Well, it's late, but it's never too late. They could come back from recess and do several things. They have tools to block all aid to Turkey. That would get Turkey's attention. Another thing they could do would be to deauthorize President Trump's action. And if Lindsey Graham is right, that 90 of them really oppose this policy, instead of just having a free ride to criticize it from afar, let them come in and put their ingenuity and vote behind stopping it.
That is former Congresswoman Jane Harman, President and CEO of the Wilson Center. Always great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
California now, where outrage is building after the utility PG&E cut power to hundreds of thousands of customers. It says to prevent wildfires during a week of strong winds. But many people are still in the dark, and they don't know yet when their power will come back on. Democratic State Senator Jerry Hill joins us now. He represents San Mateo and Santa Clara counties. Senator, what kind of burden have these outages put on people?
Well, I just saw an estimate that it's over $2 billion in fiscal loss, and the personal burden for people who can't go to work, restaurants and refrigerators, hospitals, places that rely on this power, dialysis centers are really struggling. So it's a personal impact to so many people and a business and professional impact to many people.
And we're hearing reaction from politicians around the state, including yourself, but also California Governor Gavin Newsom said this about the outages earlier this week.
No one is satisfied with this. No one is happy with this. This can't be the cause for normalcy going forward. This has to be resolved. And we have to get through the acuity of the fire season, which, remember, we're in the peak of.
And last night, you sent a letter to the California Public Utilities Commission. This is the agency that oversees PG&E, an unhappy letter calling for a review of public safety power shutoffs, which is what these are called. But Senator, can you explain who is responsible for making this decision? Because it sounds like PG&E is following rules that have been set out by the state, or at least has permission from the state to do it.
Well, they absolutely do have permission. The safety of these investor-owned utilities and the power that they distribute is up to them in terms of making that crucial decision of whether to power on or power off. And that's the challenge that we're faced with, is because PG&E and any utility would be very, you know, they want to be cautious. They don't want any more wildfires, especially PG&E, who is currently in bankruptcy because of the wildfires of the last 2 years. So they will make the decision unilaterally without any oversight or review. And that's why I sent the letter.
Do you think they've gone too far?
Well, I don't know. I can't make that decision. And that's why I think we need the regulator of this of these utilities to step in and monitor and not necessarily make the decisions, because the on the ground is the best place, but to oversee to make sure that they're not overreacting.
Isn't the bigger issue here, far beyond these outages, that a state the size of California is relying on outdated electrical grids that are known to start deadly fires that kill people? How do you fix that problem?
Well, and that is a major problem. I mean, we are the fifth largest economy in the world, and we're acting as a third world nation right now, and it's third world state. This utility for the past many years, 20, 30 years, has not invested. We have provided the funds and resources to them. They've not invested the money into the infrastructure. The fires, the major fires last year, destroyed 15,000 homes. An entire city was lost. That fire was caused by a 100-year-old transmission tower. So you can blame PG&E and the utility for this, but we also have to blame the regulator, the California Public Utilities Commission, for not doing their job over the years. And we are reforming that agency now to make sure that it is responsive and providing that safe utility.
What do you make of the argument that no matter how inconvenient these outages are, and they are very inconvenient, that it is worth it if they save lives?
Well, it would be worth it, and if it's saving lives, but the problem is with this utility, the fact that it is owned by Wall Street hedge funds, that safety has never been a priority, and the bottom line has been the priority. And are they doing this to protect for the exposure to liability, or are they doing it in the best interest of the community? That's what we don't know. That's what we need to find out as we move through this fire season.
Do you think people should be prepared that once the lights come back on this time, that it might just be a couple of days or a couple of weeks until it happens again? Because we're in the height of fire season, and this isn't getting any better.
Sadly, Peter, you're absolutely correct. And that is exactly what may happen. And that's why the Public Utilities Commission needs to take some aggressive action to monitor, to do a root cause analysis on what occurred during this last few days, because it is totally unacceptable. The communication has been wrought with challenges, and that's why people are so upset and frustrated by this deenergization.
Jerry Hill is a Democratic state senator that represents Silicon Valley in California. Senator, thanks so much for your time, and good luck out there.
Thank you very much. My pleasure. We need the luck.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, one of the hosts of On Point, the NPR show that takes you behind the headlines. We've done a deep dive series on education, and all episodes are available to binge now. Listen to On Point now on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
You probably know Jimmy Fallon as host of The Tonight Show on NBC.
Trump told his staff to do whatever it takes to stop anyone from saying anything that could endanger his presidency. And his staff was like, okay, and duct taped his mouth shut.
What you might not know is that Fallon is also the author of a number of picture books for parents and their young children, including one that is out this week. It's called This Is Baby, and Jimmy Fallon joins us from New York. Welcome.
Oh, Jeremy, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate this.
Well, and I have to say, I don't have kids, but I had no idea that you were moonlighting as a New York Times bestselling picture book author. How did that start?
I did it as a goof. I did it, a book called Your Baby's First Word Will Be Dada. And I did it as a fun thing because I really wanted my daughter to say Dada first instead of
instead
Mama.
Of Mama.
It was not a real competition, but secretly it is. I mean, you kind of want the baby to say Dada first. So I did this book where everything is like, I mean, when I talk to my daughter, I would give her bottles of milk and whatever, and I go, Dada? Dada? Do you want Dada? I mean, I don't care if she's stupid. I go, well, she'll figure it out. She'll be smart one day. But I just want the first word to be Dada. So the first book was like Dada moo, Dada quack, Dada, you know, all different animal sounds. And what happened was it sold like 2 million copies or something. It went crazy. And I started getting videos from people saying like, hey, my kid's actually reading the book back to me. And then I got videos and tweets from teachers saying, Jimmy, this book is actually pretty good. Like, kids are actually finding the confidence in reading. They actually enjoy reading books. You're making a smart child. And I was like, oh, my God. Of course, that's what I planned all along. I'm a genius.
Well, and this one, by the way, is all about the body parts of a baby. This is baby's nose. These are baby's eyes.
Yeah. What I did with this one is like I just wanted to make it fun. I mean, I can speak for tired parents out there, and I am a tired parent. And I usually read 3 books to my kids before they go to sleep, and it's tough. At some point, you go, dude, I can't read anymore. I'm actually – you have to go to sleep, and this is annoying. This is awful. So this book you can read in 20 seconds or you can read for 20 minutes. It's up to you.
Do you remember what you read when you were a young kid?
Yeah. There was one book. No one likes it. No one knows it. But it's called Here Comes the Strikeout. And it really changed my life. I loved it because it was about a kid that kept striking out at baseball, and he kind of got bullied. And then at one point he got a hit at the end of the story. I think it told me in my brain, like, keep trying and don't give up.
Okay, so then let me then transition to asking you about the fact that you right now have a job that for many people and some of your predecessors, it was like the career-ending job that they had, that they made it by the time they got to The Tonight Show. How does that feel now? Because you're only in your 40s to have that role.
I mean, it's the best. I mean, I'm very lucky to have, fun people around me and to be able to have had a career in this business. It's like I've been at NBC for 20 years. That's crazy. Mm-hmm. It makes no sense. It's like I feel like I'm still a kid, you know, but I'm not. I'm 45. But it's like I'm like Al Roker. It's like, dude, I've been there that long. Where it's like, what? It's weird. And I still got years to go.
Does it feel like a different time right now? I mean, we're doing a two-hour-a-day news program, and obviously the last couple of years have been different than ever before. But
do you hate what you're doing? Do you like?
No, I love it. I mean, it's interesting. I get to talk to different people every day, and I enjoy following what's going on in the world. But you're doing that in a similar way, different. But I mean, does it feel different to you right now? Do you like it?
It's not the Obama era, which was all I knew. You know, was the Obama era, and I loved it. And we made jokes about him and made fun of him. We wore, like, khaki pants. That was the joke of him. It's, like, hilarious that
– Or dad jeans, right.
That was the biggest joke you could make about Obama. And this guy now is just – every day he knows what he's doing, by the way. He actually knows show business. So he's in the headlines every day for a reason. No matter what you say about this guy, and if you like him, hate him, he's in the conversation every single day. And so you can make other jokes, but the headlines are him.
And I would say you're the first host of The Tonight Show that has really had to think about social media in a big way in terms of what you're doing. Is that as important to you, the things that will be viewed a million times on social media the next day, as what's on the air on television that night?
Yeah, it's different. It's totally different crowd and different audience. And I don't care what any research person will tell you. I'll be the first person to say there is no connection from social media to linear viewing. There's 18-year-olds, there's 13-year-olds watching Tonight Show online. Mm-hmm. They have no idea what television is. Like, they don't even understand what that is. They go, what?
Right.
Of course it is. I have fans from Germany, from Dubai, and you're like, where do you see me? Is it on, like, television, Sky TV or something? They go, YouTube. And it's like, wow. It's sad to say that TV's dying, but it's kind of dying. And I'm happy that social media exists because people get to watch your stuff and get to see your bits. I remember my producer Gavin, when we first started, he told me about Twitter. And I signed up for Twitter, and I remember getting 100 followers. And I'm like, oh my gosh, dude, we have 100 followers. That's 100 more people that are going to watch this show. It's amazing.
And now you have 51 million followers on Twitter.
51 million.
51.4 million. We can't forget about the 0.4.
Thank you. but it's crazy to think about that. Like, I was so excited about 100 people. 51 million people now follow me on Twitter. And I don't think it leads into The Tonight Show that much. You know, I don't think it actually does anything. I think people online are
online.
It's
a different audience.
I believe it is. Do you find people listen to you in their cars or on their apps or what?
I mean, I think it's all over the place, but it's definitely a different group of people that are listening on podcasts, that are listening on, you know, some digital devices as opposed to
What do your bosses want you to do? They want you to go to NPR.com?
.org, Jimmy.
Jesus. I don't have a radio in my house. And
well,
we
will send you a radio so that you have one, just in case the power.
But what
and the,
would that
the,
be when I
out.
When I open the box? What does it look like, Jeremy?
It's got two little
Describe
speakers.
Describe it to me.
It's got two little speakers and a dial. Usually, it's digital now.
Oh my God!
All right, let me ask you one more thing, because before I talked to you, I went back and watched an episode of SNL when you were on, and it's one that actually a friend told me. He said, "Oh my God, Remember when Jimmy Fallon couldn't stop laughing in that Debbie Downer episode? And so I went and watched it.
I was good in that.
It was great. No, it was amazing. It was hilarious. But
I barely broke.
How often now do you have laughing fits?
It's funny that I became the guy that laughs. I'm the thing. But it's like it's funny. When I first started SNL, I was the impersonation guy. They go, oh, my God, he does great impersonations. Then it was the guy who laughed at himself. Then it was Weekend Update guy. Mm-hmm. But it's like hilarious. But the one that comes back to me is that I laughed all the time. And I only laughed at like maybe like 5 or 6 sketches. But it's famous sketches.
Well, it was infectious, even for the people who were on stage with you.
I did not want to do it. I really felt bad. To be really honest, I was out of my league. And I was in a sketch with the funniest human beings on earth. So I didn't know what to do. So I started laughing. And they were like, dude, you can't laugh. And I go, but it's funny. They go, yeah, but you're in the sketch. You can't laugh at the sketch. You're in the sketch. Will Ferrell was one of the funniest human beings I ever worked with. And I did Cowbell. I think it was the first sketch that I broke in. And when we did the bit, when he was hitting the cowbell, his shirt rose up so much, his whole gut, his whole stomach was hanging out. And then even Christopher Walken was like upping his game. He was almost doing an impression of himself. He was like going like, you know, we've got to have cowbell. Like he wasn't even talking like a human. And it was the funniest thing I've ever actually was witness to in my life.
Wow.
And I lost it.
But the thing is, if you could pick anything to do all day long, anybody, I would think that laughing would be at the top of the list. Imagine.
It should be.
Yeah.
You choose to laugh. You choose to cry. You choose to do anything. That's your choice.
I think we have the subject for your next book, Laughing.
Jesus. Is it too serious? It's too serious.
That is Jimmy Fallon, whose new book is This Is Baby. He's also, of course, the host of The Tonight Show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Jeremy, you're the best. Thank you for doing this. And honestly, I want to tune in to radio to listen to you.
We're sending you a radio.
Please send me a radio. And I'm telling you, you're keeping people listening. And that's a great thing.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
It's been about a year since Hurricane Michael hit the Florida panhandle as a Category 5 storm. It was the strongest storm to strike the U.S. since Hurricane Andrew in 1992. A year later, people are still struggling to get by. In the small town of Greenwood, the recovery has slowed because the town's only grocery store caught fire and still hasn't reopened. Robbie Gaffney of member station WFSU reports.
We can start bagging stuff up. I need the meats.
The line to get fresh produce is hours long near the Greenwood Baptist Church.
Can I have somebody for the watermelon?
Volunteers plop watermelons and bags of sweet potatoes into car trunks while others hand out barbecue sandwiches, something Anita Crawford needs after her house was leveled by Michael. She's waiting in her car at the tail end of the line, which snakes around the church.
I believe we are the forgotten county, Jackson County, especially Greenwood.
Jackson County is small and rural. Fewer than 50,000 people live in the county west of Tallahassee. Christina Jeter is one of many here since the storm who is living with mold, no air conditioning, and a fallen tree in her home.
We didn't even have electricity for months. We lived without running water for I don't even know how long.
Jeter worked as a caregiver for a woman in Greenwood who died after the hurricane. so Jeter has taken up roofing to get by. She says the Greenwood supermarket was integral to the community, and it's been tough not having it.
We don't have a kitchen. So if the deli was here, we could have hot food every day.
Greenwood has no restaurants, no gas stations, and for the past year, no grocery store. The supermarket caught fire after the storm. The owners applied for a loan in January, but the flames burned all their paperwork and it slowed the approval process. The nearest grocery store is in the next town over, about 10 minutes away. But many cars were destroyed or damaged in the hurricane, so Jeter has had to live off the Dollar General. But it doesn't stock fresh produce. That's prompted some neighbors to reach out to food banks. When Jeter can't get donations, she has to walk to the Dollar General.
It's basically if you want anything, want something to drink, you want sugar, you want toilet paper, you want anything, you either walk or beg for a ride. And you can only ask for a ride so many times before it becomes a burden to somebody else.
It's about a 45-minute walk, and the path is treacherous. Cars and trucks zoom by, and there's not much sidewalk. April Garrett's family has made that trek from their home to that store, too. She says it was horrible. A tree fell on her car during the hurricane, and she can't afford to get it fixed. Garrett says her husband has been out of a job because he couldn't make it to work.
He was a non-stop worker. Even on his sick days, he never not showed up for work. He was always there on time.
She's had help from Missy Harkis, one of the organizers of Greenwood's food giveaways. Harkis says people have survived by relying on their neighbors because, she says, they're the only ones they can count on.
It's hard. It's been very, very hard, you know, trying to support this community just as a volunteer basis alone and without having any help from the government. And it's just us doing it by ourselves, you know, making between 30, 40 hours worth of phone calls a week just to get some food in.
And they're going to keep doing it until that grocery store reopens. For NPR News, I'm Robbie Gaffney.
With all the news going on recently, it's been hard to find time to talk about the campaigning that's been happening in the Democratic field for president. There are less than 4 months left until the Iowa caucuses, so let's check in on the race now, starting with this news from yesterday that former Vice President Joe Biden is calling for President Trump's impeachment for the first time.
To preserve our Constitution, our democracy, our basic integrity, he should be impeached.
Let's bring in NPR political correspondent Scott Detrow, who's been following the campaign. Hi, Scott.
You know, it's hard times for a political campaign reporter, like you said. It's just not the top story.
You can't get on the show, right? Well, here you are. So Biden has previously called for an impeachment inquiry, but yesterday he actually came out for impeachment himself. What prompted that?
You know, I think one big reason is that it's honestly in line with where most Democrats are right now. We saw a major uptick in support for impeachment overall in a lot of polls over the last week. But the biggest shift initially was among Democrats. It went from something that most Democratic voters were split on to something that, you know, 8 in 10, 9 in 10 Democrats agree on. That's part of it. The argument that Biden made yesterday is that just a series of actions by President Trump and the Trump administration over the past week or so has really clarified this for Biden, among them being in public and saying, China, I welcome your interference as well. And then the step earlier this week of sending a letter to Congress saying we are not going to cooperate in any way, shape or form, which Nancy Pelosi and other Democrats have said could lead to an article of obstruction impeachment.
Have the other major candidates on the Democratic side also come out in favor of impeachment?
Yeah. And it's worth noting that Biden was actually out of step with most of the Democratic field on this. Elizabeth Warren, senator from Massachusetts, came out in favor of impeachment months ago this spring, shortly after the Mueller report came out. Her argument was that the details in the Mueller report, especially the 10 instances of possible obstruction, was enough for her. Bernie Sanders was kind of in between the two, coming out for impeachment only more recently, but a little bit before Biden.
Let's talk about Bernie Sanders, because he is now back on the campaign trail after suffering what he called a minor heart attack. Initially, he said he would change the nature of his campaign, but then on NBC yesterday, he said he misspoke. Here he is.
Well, the word was I was going to slow down. Surprise, surprise, that we're not going to tomorrow start doing four events a day. But we're going to get back into the groove of a vigorous, very vigorous campaign.
Scott, what has this heart attack meant for Sanders' campaign for president?
Well, it means that it's basically on pause right now. He has not done any public events since the episode. His campaign is only committing to saying he will be back for the debate, and has not made it clear one way or another whether he will do any events between now and then. I think in raw political terms, Bernie Sanders probably benefited from the intense focus on impeachment right now. This story that he had a heart attack. Pretty major story. First of all, the Sanders campaign did not release that key detail until several days after the fact, late in the evening on Friday, once he was also released from the hospital. Hmm. But it certainly calls into question the fact that Bernie Sanders, 78 years old, if elected, he would be the oldest president elected. Same goes for Joe Biden, and the current record is held by President Trump. And Elizabeth Warren is 70 as well. So the top four candidates on both sides are all in their 70s, and one of them suffering a heart attack, I think, really underscores that fact.
If Sanders does lose momentum as a result of this, where does the support for him and all the money he's been raising go, do you think?
Yeah, I think we would need to look for a lot of polls to make that inference at this point, certainly. But, you know, over the last few months, Sanders' support has remained relatively steady, but it's gone down a little bit. And that's happened as Elizabeth Warren has steadily gained ground. I think Warren is most likely the beneficiary of that. Right now, if you combine Warren and Sanders' support, it's far ahead of Joe Biden, but he's still neck and neck with Warren in the polls in the key states, in most of the key states, and nationally, because the progressive base is split right now.
Let's talk about Senator Warren, who has faced a controversy in recent days over whether she was pushed out of a teaching job for being pregnant, which we should note is an experience that many women report having gone through from the 60s through more recent days. Here's what Warren said, first of all, in a 2007 interview, suggesting that her decision to leave the school was her choice.
I actually didn't have the education courses, so I was on an emergency certificate, it was called. And I went back to graduate school and took a couple of courses in education and said, I don't think this is going to work out for me.
Okay, and here's how she's been describing the experience more recently. This is her at the last debate in September.
But at the end of that first year, I was visibly pregnant. And back in the day, that meant that the principal said to me, wished me luck and hired someone else for the job.
What do we know about this, Scott?
She did a long interview with CBS. It was Department of Interesting Timing that CBS had apparently been working on this story for several weeks, if not months, and then another outlet posted right beforehand. Her response to the change of story was pretty matter of fact, and I think it's something that a lot of people could understand, as opposed to a lot of stories about politicians shifting their stories. And that was this, that once she became a U.S. senator, once she became more of a public figure in public office, she decided to be more comfortable and honest about an experience of discrimination in her past. And from the moment that she wrote about it in her book going forward, she has said that she was let go, fired, shown the door. The way that she puts it, it seems like it was an ambiguous situation with a clear outcome of you no longer work here. So that's what she's saying. And her campaign has really leaned into the fact that story probably strikes true with a lot of women over a lot of decades, including recently, as you said. I think it really underscores one key point, though, and that is, by and large, Elizabeth Warren has been able to set the terms of her coverage so far. She has been only recently the front runner. She's been giving a stump speech, rolling out policies, and really defining her own story. But when you're the front runner, as I think you could argue she now is, a lot of other campaigns start circling you, doing opposition research. Reporters start digging in.
You get more negative attention, basically.
Exactly. And I think Warren is going to have to, as Joe Biden has for months now, respond to stories that they wouldn't necessarily want to be talking about a lot more now.
And when you say she's the front runner, that's because now when you look at the average of polls in some, she's actually ahead of Joe Biden.
I think that's one key metric. And another thing that really underscored that to me is that she raised about $10 million more than Joe Biden last quarter, even though Joe Biden does a ton of high-dollar fundraisers and Warren does not do any of them.
Scott, there are a number of other candidates. We're not going to get to all of them in this segment, but there is one other one that I want to talk about because he's now in the top four in the Iowa polls. That's Mayor Pete Buttigieg of South Bend, Indiana, and he's at 11% in Iowa, just behind Bernie Sanders at 12%. He has made a point not to fundraise off of the impeachment inquiry in Congress, although he does support impeachment. Tell us about his campaign, and does he have a chance in Iowa?
Yeah, and I think, you know, look, we focus on the top polling candidates with a lot of our attention, and I think there's a lot of reasons to do that. But the caucuses are 4 months away. The caucuses do have a long, rich history of breaking late in the game and seeing somebody as a surging candidate who might not really appear on the radar until December or so. Pete Buttigieg is really positioning himself in an interesting way. I'm actually going to head to Iowa right after the debate next week to cover him for a little bit and look at this. He's got a lot of money, so he's got the resources to hire staff. He's got a lot of excitement and a lot of people who want to volunteer for his campaign. So he's got a lot of boots on the ground, knocking on doors, doing the type of organizing that you need to do to have the possibility of catching momentum at a late stage. I think Buttigieg, one more quick point on this, Buttigieg is one of several candidates whose path to success really relies on Joe Biden possibly fading. So I think he's positioning himself to see if, and again, the polls hasn't really shown this yet, if Joe Biden does start to fade because of the rise of Warren or because of the scrutiny that Trump is putting on him or a bunch of other factors, Buttigieg seems like he's going to be ready with the dollars and the people and the strategy to try and take advantage in Iowa.
Finally, you mentioned the debate, the fourth debate. It's coming up next week. There are going to be even more candidates on one stage than we've seen in the last few debates.
Too many. 12 candidates on one stage. And if you thought those 10-person stages were hard to hear from everybody, it's going to be even worse. 12 candidates. I think just, you know, look at this conversation and look at a lot of the coverage as a whole. I think the thing I'm interested in the most is the Buttigieg, the Cory Bookers, the Kamala Harris's, the Amy Klobuchar's of the world. How do they take advantage of the questions that they will get pretty infrequently, you know, every 15, 20 minutes or so at best in their position? Mm-hmm. Can they give a reason for voters to give them a second look?
That is NPR political correspondent Scott Detrow. Again, we are less than 4 months away from the Iowa caucuses, and Scott is covering it all. Thank you.
Thanks. Talk soon.
The Nobel Prize in Literature has been awarded to two writers, Polish novelist Olga Tokarczuk and Austrian writer Peter Handke. Handke is probably best known outside of Europe for his collaborations with the German filmmaker Wim Wenders, and Olga Tokarczuk became the first writer from Poland to win the Man Booker International Prize last year for her novel Flights. Let's bring in NPR's Lynn Neary. Hi, Lynn.
Hi.
And remind us, why are there two winners announced today?
Well, 2 years ago, the Swedish Academy, which awards the Literature Prize, was embroiled in a scandal when the husband of a member of the Academy was accused of sexually abusing or harassing 18 women, and he was later found guilty of rape. There were also accusations of financial impropriety that involved the leaking of names of winners for gambling purposes, and to make matters worse, the Academy had been giving money to a cultural organization that this couple owned. So all this led to a lot of infighting in what had always been thought of as a very staid organization, and a lot of Academy members stepped down either under pressure or in protest. Now, there is an institutional rule that made it impossible for them to be replaced, and that meant that there weren't enough active members to choose a winner in 2018. So the Academy regrouped, made some changes, and they decided they would name two winners this year, one for 2018, one for 2019.
And the winner in 2019 is Peter Handke. He was born in southern Austria on the border with the former Yugoslavia. What can you tell us about him and what he's done with his career?
Well, he's a multi-talented avant-garde Austrian writer. He's a novelist, a playwright, a screenwriter, poet, essayist, and one of his best-known works is a memoir about his mother called A Sorrow Beyond Dreams. Mm. Hanka garnered attention with his very first play in 1966. It was called Offending the Audience, which I think signals something right there. And it involved four actors sitting around talking about theater, and then they took turns insulting and then praising the audience for its performance. He had a bestseller in Europe in 1970 with the novel The Goalie's Anxiety at the Penalty Kick. It's a thriller about a former soccer player who commits a murder, and it was made into a film by the director Wim Wenders. Hanka and Wenders collaborated on a number of projects, and I think perhaps most famously on the 1987 film Wings of Desire, which Hanka co-wrote with Wenders.
And it sounds like, politically speaking, he's a kind of controversial figure.
Yeah, I mean, you might have expected that the Swedish Academy would make a safe choice this year to avoid any more controversy, but Hanka has invited controversy since the start of his career. Most recently, he's come under fierce criticism for his support of Slobodan Milosevic, the Serbian leader who died before he could be tried for war crimes. Hanka eulogized Milosevic at his funeral, and in response, officials in Germany tried to revoke a prestigious literary award, but he refused to accept that award before it could be officially withdrawn. He was asked about his support for Milosevic in a 2006 interview with the New York Times. He said that he thought Milosevic was not a hero, but a tragic human being. And he continued, "I am a writer, not a judge."
All right, let's talk about the 2018 winner. That's Olga Tokarczuk. She studied psychology at the University of Warsaw before she became a writer. Tell us more about her.
That's right. She set out to be a psychologist, but turned to writing, she claims, when she realized that she was more disturbed than her patients, she said. And I think that may be a wise choice because she has emerged as one of Poland's most prominent writers. She has twice won Poland's highest literary honor, the Nike Award, and she also won the Man Booker International Prize in 2018 for Flights. She calls this a constellation novel, but one reviewer described it as a cacophony of voices and stories seemingly unconnected across time and space. She was the first writer from Poland to win that prize, and her novel Drive Your Plow Over the Bones of the Dead was nominated for this year's international prize as well. She has a novel coming out in this country next year. It's called The Book of Jacob. This was a controversial book in Poland. It was critically acclaimed. It was a bestseller there, but some were offended. They thought it they felt it was a depiction of Poles as anti-Semitic. She received death threats and was targeted by right-wing extremists. Her publisher actually hired a bodyguard for her protection. She said she spent 8 years researching the book and was being attacked by, quote, people who didn't want to know about Poland's dark past. Swedish Academy member Andrew Olsen said today that her work is full of wit and cunning.
So you've described two writers who have somewhat controversial pasts. Were you surprised by these choices?
I think it was surprising for a couple of reasons. First of all, the Academy seemed to be inviting controversy by choosing Hanka. And, you know, he has actually called for the Nobel to be abolished. So let's see if he even shows up at the awards ceremony. But beyond that, they formed a new committee to make these recommendations. And they included five outside experts, not part of the Swedish Academy. And they were sort of promoting the idea that they were going to move past a sort of Eurocentric and male-dominated kind of choice. One of the winners is a woman, but certainly these are both European writers, and I think a lot of people were expecting to see at least one of the winners to be from some other part of the world.
That's NPR's Lynn Neary. Lynn, thanks so much.
It was good to be here.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.